Are you going to run for president?
If there's nobody else to do it, then of course I would believe that we should do this.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And of course, this is the gala final edition of the It's All Politics podcast before the election of 2010. And Ken, I think we ought to take a page from the former governor of Alaska's book and make the same pledge.
That we no longer do, if somebody else can do the podcast, we step back?
If there's someone who's willing to be the three C's, conservative, common sense.
And Kentucky.
And Constitution passionate. If we can find two people who can spell that podcast, then we should step back.
America has been calling for a new leadership in the podcast, and I think we're going to see a referendum on the podcast on November 2nd, as I think we're going to see a referendum on the last two, if not last 4 years, of Democratic rule.
That's right. Now, if you will, a referendum on the last two referenda. Were people happy with what they got from 2008 and by that same extension 2006, or were they not? And I think we already know the answer. We're going to get into some of the details and perhaps some of the rationale, but I think we already know that the basic answer is people are not happy enough. And when the president goes on television with Jon Stewart and says,
When we promised during the campaign, change you can believe in,
right?
It wasn't change you can believe in 18 months. It was change you can believe in, but you know what? We're going to have to work for it.
That's not going to cut it. That's not going to turn an awful lot of people around.
No, it's not. And especially there was a big impatience that we saw in 2006 and 2008 that all the problems, there was Katrina and the wars and the economy and things like
debt,
that.
And the debt and taxes.
And Guantanamo, and we can go on the whole.
Afghanistan.
But I think after 4 years, the American people look at who is in charge, and the Democrats, like it or not, are in charge. You could say that these problems were well before January 20th, 2009. You could say that, you know, we had 8 years of the Bush administration and even 8 years of the Clinton administration when things were getting bad with deregulation and things like that. But when you're looking at the ballot, you're looking whom to blame, and I think Republicans are the angry suitors here, and they're going to come out and say, you know, I'm not happy with the way that things are going, and it's very possible Democrats may not come out in the same kind of numbers because they're just demoralized or saddened by what's going on.
And Democrats, by and large, are somewhat less likely voters. They tend to be somewhat less attached. They tend to be somewhat less hierarchical and driven by party organization historically. I'm just talking about historically. Next week, we'll see if this is borne out. But given those historical trends, given all of that in a year like 2010, one would expect the Republicans to have a bumper crop. And I think we're going to see a bumper crop. And one of the great ironies of that is that many of the people who come in are going to be Tea Party sympathizers, even Tea Party identified candidates, who are going to do one of the things that in polls Americans keep saying they don't want to see, which is gridlock.
But if I were a Republican strategist and I woke up on November 3rd and saw huge Republican gains, I'm going to say, well, look, the American people did not punish us, the Republicans, for being the party of no, whether it's true or not, but that charge has been out there. And so if standing up to Obama and standing up to government excess is the way to be rewarded by the voters, what is the benefit for being accommodating in 2011, 2012?
Very little incentive for compromise is probably going to be the lesson emerging from next Tuesday. But let's talk a little bit about the specific races and try to get some sort of a sense of whether or not the wave is going to be this high or that high or higher than we can measure at this point. Let's start in Wisconsin, Ken. That's a state that's very close to my heart, my first newspaper. I wonder if it's too late for Russ Feingold to make the comeback that some people see him making there.
Well, what's remarkable to me about this is that suddenly Russ Feingold is the status quo. The thing about Russ Feingold, when he was first elected to the Senate in 1992, he was the outsider, he was a new candidate, he would stand up to the establishment of both parties, and now he's become, you know, been there, done that, and at least according to Ron Johnson, the Republican millionaire businessman, Tea Party favorite, who had just been blanking the airwaves. You know something? Feingold has always made the case that I am not a knee-jerk Democrat. I don't follow the Democratic line all the way. But I think because of that, there are some Democrats who have never been madly in love with Russ Feingold. He was a little full of himself, sort of like the way many Democrats saw Arlen Specter. And I think that there may not be great enthusiasm. Now, he still is a liberal champion. We know his views on campaign finance and things like that and the war. And so I think the progressive community still has a lot invested in a Russ Feingold reelection. But right now, the polls show him down, and I haven't seen any poll that shows him up.
Pennsylvania's a little different because there the incumbent was defeated in the primary by Joe Sestak, an insurgent, if you will, from within the Democratic Party, ran against the wishes of the White House, ran against the wishes of the Democratic establishment in Pennsylvania, beat Arlen Specter, the party switcher you just mentioned a moment ago, who had soured people in both parties, I suppose, over the years, and took on Pat Toomey, the guy who looked so strong on the Republican side that he essentially drove Arlen Specter out the door.
Absolutely.
Into party switching, and Arlen Specter was quite frank and candid about that. Pat Toomey now looks like he's still several points ahead, but Joe Sestak has closed the gap, and in this case, there actually have been one or two polls that showed him a point or two ahead.
Well, there was a poll last week that showed Sestak with a lead for the first poll I've seen about with those results in the longest time, but then there was a new poll this week that had Toomey back up. Pennsylvania is very interesting in the fact that a lot has to do with circumstance and timing and things like that, because, for example, Rick Santorum, very conservative congressman who was elected to the Senate in 1994. He won it in 94 in a very, very good Republican year, lost his seat in 2006 in a very, very bad Republican year, and lost by like 17 points.
Clobbered.
He was absolutely clobbered
that
by Bob Casey. And so I think maybe perhaps if Pat Toomey were running in 2006, 2008 statewide, while he would have won the Republican primary, would have beaten Arlen Specter, he would have got clobbered again, I think, in November. Now with Obama not popular in Pennsylvania and with the Republican with a big lead in the gubernatorial contest,
absolutely,
I think Toomey just wins that one.
Of course, the race that everybody is really watching most closely in the Senate is the Nevada race. Harry Reid, the Democratic majority leader who's had such a struggle in that position for the last 4 years, he's up against Sharon Angle. She was supposedly the weakest of all the Republicans running in their primary, but she won. She had some organized Tea Party support. She got the nomination. She has been pretty effective in some of the debates and largely invisible apart from that. She hasn't done a lot of media interviews. She's been very carefully controlled in her access for the media. And now the race still looks too close to call, but she's usually on top in all these close polls.
It reminds me in many ways of what Jimmy Carter and the Democrats wished for in 1980. They thought Ronald Reagan was going to be the easiest Republican to beat. He was portrayed as an extremist, and then somehow he just managed to win over the crowd. Sharon Angle is different. She has backed down from some of her more controversial stands. She has softened her rhetoric in many ways. But the fact that Sharon Angle, who has been portrayed as this right-wing extremist, the fact that she's running dead even, if not a point or two up over Harry Reid, just shows the disfavor that Reid has fallen in a state like Nevada. If he's supposed to be the Senate Majority Leader and he's supposed to bring great things to the state of Nevada, a state that has huge unemployment, huge foreclosure rate, what's the value of having Harry Reid as my senator when he just hasn't gotten the job done? Now, I can make the case, well, there's a Republican governor in Nevada and the Republican should pay the price. But again, if Harry Reid is saying, look, I stand, you know, I'm the guy who brings things for Nevada and Nevada's hurting, then why not somebody new, even if it is somebody like Sharon Angle? I still think Reid does win.
Why?
Because I can't imagine him not winning.
But you've just laid out such a compelling scenario for why he's going to lose. The conventional wisdom in these cases is always that if an incumbent who's well-known, who has universal name recognition, can't get to 50%, can't get to even 45% approval, and if he's really running only on the unacceptability of his challenger, that's a loser. And that usually produces a big upset. And I think that's what you just described in Nevada. Now, it's a lot harder, I think, to read in a couple of the other closest races. One close to Nevada in Colorado, where you have Ken Buck, the Tea Party candidate, who is in many ways a vastly superior candidate to Sharon Angle, but who has gotten caught up in a somewhat bluer state, a somewhat more progressive state, caught up on some of his Tea Party viewpoints, anti-government viewpoints, and where Michael Bennett, an appointed senator who's only been there for 2 years, is not nearly as inherently unpopular as Harry Reid. Colorado's also not in anywhere near as bad shape as Nevada. It's not one of the worst states in the union for foreclosures and some of these other things. So that race is very close and harder to read.
But at the same time, look what's going on in the gubernatorial race in Colorado. You have John Hickenlooper, the mayor of Denver, who has a big lead, blah, blah, blah. But you have Tom Tancredo, the third-party candidate, the American Constitution Party candidate, close behind him, beating Dan Mays, the Tea Party candidate for governor. Whatever happens in the race for governor, I still think a lot of conservatives are coming out because of that gubernatorial race. And if that's the case, and that's what it looks like, mm-hmm. Ken Buck could benefit from that.
Yes.
And plus the fact we always talked about how the Colorado is becoming more blue. They won the Senate seat in 2004, the governorship in 2006, another Senate seat in 2008 with Mark Udall. And yet, now it seems to be going the opposite way. Betsy Markey, the member of Congress from Fort Collins, looked like she's gone. And I think that blue wave that was coming over Colorado seems to have dissipated completely.
Yes, it's really receded, no question about that. The interesting thing about what's going on in that gubernatorial race is that Tom Tancredo, a former Republican, actually ran for president in 2008, running essentially on a "we've got to stop illegal immigration" platform.
He was discarded completely.
He was discounted. He was not prepared to run outright for the Republican nomination. But then he gets in as a third-party candidate because Dan Mays has won, and Dan Mays has said some things that have made him look a little silly in the media, so the guy's way down in the percentages. But I think you're right. Ken Buck is going to benefit if you've got a plebiscite of all the Republicans in the state to decide on how conservative they are.
Let's go to Illinois, which has also been very, very close. This is the seat admirably represented by Roland Burris the past 19 or so months.
That's something we gratefully have not had to talk about too much
Roland
over
Burris,
those 18
no.
months.
But you have two very flawed candidates. You have Mark Kirk, the member of Congress, a moderate from the Chicago suburbs.
Who should be winning in a walk this year.
He should be winning in the walk, and I still think he does win, but somehow the things that his misrepresentation, or some people say lying about his military record, there are a lot of Democrats who are using this against Kirk. But then you have Alexei Janulius, the state treasurer, who, let's face it, whose family owned the Broadway Bank, who gave shady loans to shady characters. And again, with that and Rod Blagojevich's trial hanging over everybody, I think the Republicans win that seat.
Three other races the Democrats are really counting on that have been close at various points in the last month or so, maybe looking a little better for the Democrats right now, but certainly not to the point where they're out of the woods in any one of the three, are the two races on the West Coast, California and Washington State, and one back east here, West Virginia.
Well, let's go to the West Coast for now, just briefly, because I agree with you. I think the Democrats, these are two races that were for the longest time toss-ups, and I think the Democrats have pulled away. The news in the California senatorial contest, of course, was the hospitalization this week of Colleen Fiorina, who developed an infection. She had breast cancer surgery in 2009. She had follow-up surgery pretty recently, and there was an infection that came out of that. So she was in the hospital for a couple of days, and that was the headlines of it. But ultimately, I think that the numbers, and I haven't seen the numbers post this kind of news, and I don't know if there's any effect at all, but for the most part, I think the Democrats have come home in California, both in the gubernatorial race with Jerry Brown over Meg Whitman and Barbara Boxer. So I think Barbara Boxer keeps her seat, wins the fourth term, and I think in Washington State, Patty Murray, again, running even with Dino Rossi for the longest time, also wins the fourth term there. Two states that President Obama won comfortably in 2008, and two basically blue states.
But West Virginia, here is one of those curious cases where you would think that a candidate who has been on the ballot a number of times and been very successful and very popular in the offices he's won, up against a guy who's been on the ballot a number of times and never won, and usually not even been close, you would think that that would be a replay. But it's not.
Well, you know, Joe Manchin seems to be exactly the kind of Democrat who wins in West Virginia. And in fact, when he was reelected in 2008, he won by the largest margin of any governor in West Virginia history. He's pro-gun. He's anti-same-sex marriage.
He's pro-miner. And he was all over that mining disaster there last year, in the past year. And you would think that that would just carry him on the shoulders of voters. But the Republicans have been successful at putting him instead on the shoulders of Barack Obama.
But it also reminds me of opportunity lost. I mean, you think of, for example, the Democrats are probably saying in Illinois, if only Lisa Madigan had run for the Senate, boy, we'd have been a much better candidate. I think Republicans may be saying the same thing in West Virginia. As you point out, John Racy's run for the Senate twice before. 2006 got clobbered by Robert Byrd.
Barely, 4 years ago.
Yeah, and then in 1984 he lost to Jay Rockefeller, which was close. But again, he's seen as a perennial and unsuccessful
rich candidate. Guy who lives half the time in Florida or part of the time in Florida. And
his wife can't vote in West Virginia because she, right, exactly. Those kind of things.
You would think he would be disqualified against a highly popular Democratic governor, except for Barack Obama.
And Barack Obama, who, of course, you know, in his height of his popularity in 2008 was never popular in West Virginia. His numbers were even lower in 2010. But Manchin is the kind of Democrat, I think, who could just hold on to the seat. But again, it would be a 30-point victory had it not been for Obama.
Some news coming out of a neighboring state of West Virginia's, where coal is also a very major product, in Kentucky. We've talked about Kentucky all year long. It was a closely contested race in both parties for the nomination for the Senate. Rand Paul, of course, became the star coming out of the primaries, but Jack Conway, the Democrat who won his primary, also has made some headlines. Of course, we've made a lot of jokes about the Aqua Buddha, and we've had a lot of opportunity to laugh about this particular Senate race. It took a kind of ugly turn in the last week because of an incident right before the candidates met for a debate.
There was a MoveOn.org activist who was approaching Rand Paul with a slip of paper trying to, you know, give him a fake congratulations for being part of the Republican slash corporate monopoly, blah, blah, blah. It was, you know, it was a MoveOn.
An embarrassment effort.
MoveOn, right. And basically what happened is this woman was wrestled to the ground, and a Rand Paul campaign worker stepped on her neck, stepped on her shoulders, you know, while she was down on the ground. Now, the Rand Paul people will say, well, you know, she was approaching me. We got nervous. There are a lot of crazy people out there, and we just reacted weirdly. But, of course, stepping on anybody who's just already down on the ground, and the video just shows it, I'm not sure how it plays, just like I'm not sure how the Aqua Buddha memory plays. But, again, in an ugly year with ugly charges back and forth, this was an especially ugly incident. Having said all that, I think Rand Paul wins. It's a Republican state. Obama is not popular, and Rand Paul will be the next senator.
Ken, one of the things I've always admired about the way you do election predictions is that you actually tell us what you think. An awful lot of people who handicap politics for a living take refuge in the too-close-to-call category or the toss-up category and don't tell us what they really think is going to happen, and then they come back later and say, oh, well, that's great, I didn't miss any. Whereas, in fact, too-close-to-call never wins any elections, with the exception possibly of Florida in 2000. So do tell us, what do you think will be the final number in the Senate, Republican and Democrat?
I think Republicans will pick up 7 seats. They certainly lose none of their incumbent seats. For some reason, I still think Harry Reid holds on. And I think, of course, the Democrats win in West Virginia, California, Washington. But I think the Republicans pick up 7. That gives them 48 seats. Democrats, 50 plus the 2 independents. So it'll be a 52-48 Senate. If Harry Reid doesn't survive, then there could be very well a bloodbath between Dick Durbin and Chuck Schumer for the leadership. If Harry Reid does survive, the question is, does he want another term? Do Democrats in the Senate want him to have another term as the Republican Senate majority leader?
Is there something else they could give him that would be of greater interest and that would actually make life more livable for him and probably for the Democrats as well? I'm sure the Obama White House would support the choice of someone else as leader. This has been a typical dynamic where the White House wants somebody different, particularly in the Senate running the show. We saw that with George W. Bush trying to get Bill Frist installed as a leader. Didn't work out so well once they succeeded. But there's this huge temptation to put your thumb on the scales and get your guy or somebody you think you can work with more successfully into that job.
And for the record, no Senate majority leader has been defeated for re-election since Ernest McFarland in Arizona in 1952 to a guy named Barry Goldwater. If Harry Reid loses on Tuesday, that's just going back nearly 60 years.
All right, then what about the House? We expect the House to be a Republican House as of November 3rd. Do we expect them to have the kind of wave that would really put them in control, or do we see it as being close?
You know, Ron and I have been talking about this, and of course, Republicans need a net of 39 House seats to take control and get Boehner to Speaker. Many surveys show the Republicans gaining 50, even 60. I don't know why I'm so cautious of it, but I only have the Republicans winning 45 seats and losing 4, the one in Hawaii, Louisiana, the Mark Kirk seat in Illinois, and the Mike Castle seat in Delaware. That's 4, which is a net gain for the Republicans of only 41.
Just 2 to spare.
2 to spare. So, I mean, I could be way wrong. Of course, if it's a wave and members of Congress we never thought were in trouble, they go down, then my numbers could be nonsensical and embarrassing. But right now, calling everyone without having any toss-up race, I think the Republicans have a net gain of 41. Either way, they get control of the House, but not by the margins I've been seeing in the papers.
I think the consensus has pretty much settled at something like 50 to 55 seats, with some people hedging their bets by saying, but it could be much bigger. It could be really scary, kids, 60 or 70. And I think that the consensus is based on an awful lot of numerical material and an awful lot of objective assessment of where races stand. We don't know, of course, in the end, what exactly the number will be. But I think that probably you're being a little overly cautious, and the Republicans will do a little better than you're anticipating.
And let's just say the Republicans do pick up 50. Basically, it's just a correction from what happened in 2006 and 2008.
It takes us back to the status quo ante.
Exactly. Right before 2006, when the Democrats got 30 in 2006, 21 in 2008, with some special elections along the way, and if the Republicans are plus 50, 55, whatever it is, we're back where we were in early 2006.
All right. We need to touch on the governors because people care about their governors. We touched on Colorado
governors
already.
Governors are very important.
And governors are hugely important. And yes, redistricting is coming up. And yes, there's a presidential campaign coming up in which governors can sometimes be of tremendous help to a candidate of their own party. Yes, yes.
Yes.
But let's go quickly through the governors. We already touched on Colorado. Illinois, Pat Quinn, the incumbent, the guy who replaced Rod Blagojevich. What thanks does he get?
Well, I mean, first of all, he was never wildly popular. He was kind of like a policy wonk kind of guy.
He was a lot like this podcast.
Right? But what's amazing about this is you have a guy named Bill Brady, who's a downstate conservative state legislator, who I think won the Republican primary by 9 votes or something like that. It took him weeks to find out who the nominee was. And yet he has led Pat Quinn in every poll I've seen. Again, he doesn't have a power base. He doesn't have a center of population.
He has a sense of timing.
Well, who knew?
Run in 2010. Best advice any Republican has ever been given. Run in 2010. Wave election.
And yet, you know, you think when Blagojevich won in 2002, reelected in 2006, I mean, the Republicans were so discredited. George Ryan, the scandals, enough, you know, a gazillion years of Republican rule.
Memories are very short.
Very,
Maine.
Absolutely.
Talk about Maine.
I remember the Maine.
Tea Party candidate there. Kind of an outspoken guy. Maybe not a Carl Palladino like New York.
Oh, no.
But pretty outspoken guy.
Yeah, Paula Page is a very conservative guy, but he also has the advantage of an independent Elliot Cutler, who's also in the race, who seems to be taking votes away from the Democratic candidate.
Siphoning
from Elizabeth Mitchell, who, if you remember, ran and lost to Bill Cohn for the Senate back in 1984.
Yes, blue-eyed Bill Cohn.
But so looks like the Republicans will pick up that seat, and there'll be a lot of Republican gubernators who are going to win on Tuesday. I think the Republicans will win in Illinois. I think they're going to win in Ohio.
So you're saying Ted Strickland, after being so popular just 2 years ago that either Democratic candidate would have loved to have had him on their ticket, said no to both, gone.
Ohio has lost 400,000 jobs since Ted Strickland was elected. You can make the case, well, it's not the Democrats' fault. It's the Bush economy. It's the Rob Portman economy. Meanwhile, the Rob Portman economy, he's winning 20 points in the Senate race. Kasich is a flawed candidate again. He's a former Lehman Brothers guy who went to Lehman Brothers after he was serving Congress after he left.
None of that matters.
It doesn't matter.
None of that matters. The voters are only looking at who's got the ball, and they're not looking at who had the ball back last time. So let's talk about three other states. Florida looks like a real cliffhanger.
But that is fascinating because one is one of those states that gained seats in the next census.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, whoever's governor will be very, very crucial to drawing the lines. You have Alex Sink, the state's CFO. She would be the first woman elected governor of Florida. And you have Rick Scott, who's a multimillionaire, former healthcare executive, who is very charismatic and running great commercials. However, the CEO of Columbia HCA, the large healthcare company, that company paid a record $1.7 billion Medicare fine.
You know, I think we could argue that something like that should have disqualified Rick Scott at some point or another.
The Republican primary.
Back in the primaries or since the primaries, at some point or another, people should have come to some sort of grips with that and said, whoa, this is the last guy I want to have in charge. But it hasn't. And because it hasn't, and we're down to the last days, and he's survived that, I would say he's going to be elected
governor.
I'm
not convinced of that. I still think that independents are breaking Sink's way. And again, this should be a Republican year in Florida, a state like Florida. Certainly Marco Rubio will be a big winner in the Senate race.
Huge winner.
But
and a lot of conservatives coming out there just because they're so mad still at Charlie Crist, who's running as an independent against Rubio for
the Senate race. Right. So in that sense, Rick Scott could win it. But I think that's one of those, like Nevada, in my view, is a dead even race right now.
I understand. But my money is double on the Republicans. Those two big statewide races in Florida. Odd situation in Minnesota where you've got another three-way race, and it's the three-way races that are so hard to read. Tom Emmer is the very conservative Republican nominee, and you would think this would be his year to pull the Minnesota governorship away from the moderate wing of the Republican Party, Tim Pawlenty, if you will, except that you've got a three-way contest and a very well-known politician who, inexplicably has not worn out his welcome in Minnesota, Mark Dayton, a guy who was a United States senator, apparently decided he didn't really want to be one. Most everybody agreed he wasn't doing the job. He was having lots of personal problems that were keeping him from doing the job.
Depression, alcoholism.
A recurrence of his alcoholism. He just was gone. He was finished. He was done in politics. Here he is back. He's leading in the polls. How could that possibly be true?
Well, there's a third-party candidate who has links to the Republican Party moderate wing, and perhaps that person will be taking a lot of Emmer votes away from him.
How about Rhode Island? Yet another three-way race. Here you have the Democratic nominee not only distancing himself from Barack Obama, but Barack Obama distancing himself from the Democratic nominee, possibly because he personally prefers Link Chafee, the independent, who, when he was a Republican, was in the Senate with Barack Obama, and they were friends.
And Mr. Capriero was not happy about that lack of endorsement this week in a radio interview.
But I never asked for President Obama's endorsement. He could take his endorsement and really shove it, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think that pretty much covers it. Quickly now, two things we very rarely talk about, local politics and ethics. Let's start with the local politics. In Chicago, Rahm Emanuel has eliminated, apparently persuaded, Louis Gutierrez not to run. And now, mysteriously, the Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart, whom a lot of people thought would be the toughest candidate against Rahm Emanuel, has decided not to run.
I thought Tom Dart was going to be a very strong candidate and perhaps had a chance of beating Rahm Emanuel, but he announced this week that he wants to spend more time with Rahm Emanuel's children, which is a surprise. But I think what it does, it makes Rahm Emanuel the odds-on favorite.
Unbelievable. After just a few weeks in the field, one almost begins to wonder if Rahm Emanuel was working all of this weeks and months ago instead of that other job he had. Refresh my memory. All right, ethics. Two trials, people well known from their service in the House of Representatives. One is beginning next week. One is going to begin after the election. The first one that's going to begin is down in Texas, and it involves our old friend Tom DeLay.
Right, Tom DeLay, who has been accused and been indicted of money laundering regarding the 2002 redistricting and things like that, what he tried to do with the independent expenditures that may have not been that independent. He's being tried in Austin, Texas, which is of
Travis
course,
County.
Travis County, which is a travesty if you're a Republican. The jury has been chosen, and the trial begins next week. The feeling of many Republicans is that they feel this is just a political sham of a trial, and so they're not as concerned, but they fear the Travis County aspect of it. But there's also another news with Charlie Rangel.
Charlie Rangel is awaiting trial, as we call it a trial. It's actually some kind of a committee proceeding in the Ethics Committee of the House. He has parted ways with his attorney, presumably the guy who was advising him throughout this entire ordeal.
And who Charlie Rangel has been spending over millions of dollars paying their firm.
I think being Charlie Rangel's lawyer is pretty much a full employment act. But now there's some question as to whether or not that trial might be delayed further because of this change.
And speaking of delay, Rod Blagojevich's trial, which was supposed to begin in January, is now put off till next April.
I think that's a mercy for all of us. We need a little less Rod Blagojevich in our lives. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
The final pre-election podcast of 2010. You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
Yeah, cue the violins. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.